This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The 50th anniversary of John F. Kennedy's assassination prompts the well-worn question, where were you when you learned that Kennedy had been shot? Earlier this week, I spoke with Senator Patrick Leahy about where he was that day. As a young Catholic Democrat, Leahy felt a bond with the president. He was a law student at Georgetown in Washington, D.C. in November of 1963, and after hearing the shocking news from a fellow student, Leahy recalls gazing out the window of a taxi as he raced home to tell his wife.
As we went by the stockbrokers, you could see that the ticker tape that was projected on the walls had been stopped. I saw Jacqueline Kennedy's brother-in-law, whom I normally would see, going to his brokerage house in a chauffeured Rolls Royce, out desperately trying to get a cab. You could see people running out in the street. I got to our apartment. I banged on the door to wake up Marcel. She had the night latch on, the phone off the hook. She came to the door. I told her, they've shot him. And she said, who? I said, the president. And we went and turned on the TV set just as Walter Cronkite came on with a very famous announcement. And we just sat there, held on to each other, and just cried.
You also then went and watched the funeral cortege.
We did. We thought about it. Marcel was 7 months pregnant at the time, and we worried about the crowds, but we felt we had to. We took the bus, went down, stood on Pennsylvania Avenue. Hundreds upon hundreds of thousands of people. It was dead silent, and so silent that from a block away, as the streetlights changed, you could hear the click of the lights changing. Nobody was speaking. We were up near the National Art Gallery, a mile or so from the White House. We heard the drums as the cortege left the White House. We heard the horses coming down. I remember the riderless horse jumping back and forth, very lively. I remember Robert Kennedy with his chin on his hands in a car going by. Mrs. Kennedy, seeing the President Johnson, and the somberness of it, marred only by a murmur that went through the crowd that somebody had heard about the shooting of Oswald. Again, Marcel and I have talked about this so many times over the years. We know exactly what we're wearing. We can feel the weather. Every bit of it. The day of the funeral, we watched that. Watched the Haile Selassie walking side by side with Charles de Gaulle, a difference of nearly a foot and a half in their height. And I'd seen Emperor Selassie drive down in an open car just a weeks before down Pennsylvania Avenue with President Kennedy. And we watched at the funeral, we saw the missing man formation fly over Arlington Cemetery. We're not far from there. We ran outside just in time to see the jets go over. And the other thing that still chokes me up to this day, we saw Air Force One come over, and it dipped its wing. And it was just coming out of that salute as it went over our basement apartment. And it was a time of great sorrow. We had some of my classmates lived nearby. We would kind of all gather in each other's apartment and try to eat. Nobody wanted to eat.
Beyond the sorrow, was there anger or any fear of any sort in Washington?
I think there was just such total, unbelievable disbelief. And it was struck home. There's a Catholic church nearby where we'd go to Mass on Sundays. We'd gone there, and as we were coming out, saw the entourage of now President Johnson going by. He was still living in his home, which is up in Northwest Washington, until Mrs. Kennedy and the children moved out of the White House. And I don't know if it's so much fear. I don't think so much fear. It's just a horrible sense of loss. Even people who had not been supporters of President Kennedy were just shocked by it. I'd go to class, and it was so hard to concentrate. All anybody wanted to talk about was this. Marcel said when she's back at the hospital, she'd go in to help patients. I remember the VA hospital, former soldiers, they'd be sitting in their beds crying. It was a very, very – and the kind of silence as you walk down the street, the way people were, I did not see that again until 9/11.
That was Senator Patrick Leahy speaking earlier this week about his recollections of President Kennedy's assassination. Leahy was a law student in Washington, D.C. at the time. Today on Vermont Edition, we're asking you to share your recollections of where you were and how you feel Kennedy's assassination changed the social and political fabric of the United States. You can share your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Matt says online, I was a freshman at Our Lady of Lourdes High School in Poughkeepsie, New York. We were called to assembly, as always, girls on the right side of the auditorium, boys on the left. The principal, Monsignor Cox, made the announcement from the stage. It seemed I could feel the air leave the left side of the room as all of the girls gasped at once. We were dismissed for the day, a gorgeous, warm, late fall afternoon, very unlike the rainy chill here in northern Vermont today. Dan in Jonesville says, I was a junior at Otter Valley High School in algebra class when the news came over the PA that JFK had been shot. I felt a crushing sadness and disappointment. There was a definite sense that something huge had happened that would change our country and the world from that day on. And we're joined now from the Middlebury College studio by Matt Dickinson, a professor of political science at the college. He studies and teaches the presidency. Professor Dickinson, nice to talk with you again.
Great to be with you, Jane.
So you were quite small at the time of the assassination. You were a very young person. So I'm guessing you don't have many personal recollections of that actual day. But as a presidential scholar, how important a moment was it, do you think, in American culture?
Well, the fact that we're talking about it 50 years later, and public opinion polls, I happened to look today at the Gallup poll ratings of presidents, and lo and behold, among the 18 to 29-year-olds, the highest-rated modern president is John F. Kennedy. And, of course, nobody in that age group actually experienced anything about his presidency. So it's obviously an enduring legacy, and it's one that in some sense has grown stronger as the years gone by. And it's an interesting question about why it endures so long, given that his actual presidency was not noteworthy for accomplishing a lot.
So then what do you think? Why do you think it's resonated, especially with people who weren't even alive at that time?
Well, I think three factors. The most important one is, of course, how you led the broadcast today. People remember where they were when he died. His is an unfinished presidency, and as a result, it allows us to try to finish that presidency in our minds, and that becomes something of an introspective way of looking at our own current political situation and thinking how much better things were then. We tend to look back in the past with an air of nostalgia. But the other factors that sort of amplify this is his was the first television presidency, not just the assassination, but remember, he was the first president to have live press conferences. And you can look at those press conferences today at the John F. Kennedy Library website or go down there. And he was remarkably witty and charismatic and entertaining in a way that no subsequent president has been. And then, of course, there was the man himself, his charisma, his youthfulness, his vigor, and not just him, but his family, his lovely wife, his two young children. And in contrast to his predecessor, who was one of the oldest presidents ever to serve, he represented a changing of the generational guard, a new generation at a time when people still believed in the efficacy of government and what government could do to improve their lives. And so we had this confluence of television, coming of age, the charisma of the individual, and then a life so tragically cut short.
Why then, though, do you think that it still resonates so much for people who are younger than that? I mean, it's for people for whom it's not a, I remember where I was. Is it that their parents remembered where they were and this was such a pivotal moment in the previous generation's life that it has been infused into young people today?
I think that's part of it. I think the other part of it is disillusionment with politics today, the polarization of Washington politics. And there's a sense that it must have been better back then. And the other thing that I alluded to is Kennedy serves at a time when we still believed in the role of government. And there is a young generation here who has never seen that. For the most part, the legacy that Kennedy tried to instill through the Alliance for Progress and the Peace Corps, that is not a legacy that was carried through in subsequent presidents. In fact, you know, when you think of Ronald Reagan, Ronald Reagan's slogan is, you know, the solution to our ills is not government. Government's the problem. And nobody's really recaptured that particular ethos of public service. And I think young people have a longing for a return to that type of approach to solving problems, a collective approach that's rooted in public service.
We're giving people space today to share their reflections on what Kennedy's assassination meant to them, or to talk a little bit about how they think it has affected American culture and politics into today. Cynthia in Burlington says, I was a freshman at Boston University in 1963. I was walking down Commonwealth Avenue to class. The warm sun was in my face. It nearly blinded me. Just as I was about to cross the street, a cloud blocked the sun and the scene became visible. Something was dreadfully wrong. People were pulling their cars over to the curb. Some stopped in the middle of the street. Everyone was confused. Some were crying. It was surreal. A perfectly well-dressed woman, she could have been a professor, was standing on the curb sobbing. I gently touched her shoulder and asked, "What's wrong?" Without looking up, she responded, "The president was shot." That began my political awakening. The world was not what it had seemed when I got up that morning. And let's go to Ed calling in from Addison. Hi, Ed. Go ahead.
Hi. I was a junior in high school at the time, and I remember being in health class, of all things, and they made the announcement, and we walked out into the hallway, and I saw a good friend of mine who happened to be, at the time, a big supporter of Barry Goldwater, and he was smiling, and it was just such a shock, and I remember sort of turning away and shaking my head, and it's always kind of stuck with me that anybody could have been smiling at that point. It was such the one word that comes to mind always about that whole weekend was just sadness, how sad everything was. And I think as far as the, you know, what Professor Dickinson just said, I don't think there's been a president since, certainly, that's challenged the country in a way that Kennedy did, and with all his faults, he had an amazing ability to do that, and I think he was very successful at that.
Well, Ed, thanks for sharing your reflection. Appreciate that. Let's hear from Bob in Piermont, New Hampshire. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Yeah, good morning. I remember how, boy, distinctly, I was a young sergeant in the Special Forces, and I was at Fort Devens, and we were training a part of the 5th Division that had a brigade there on unconventional warfare, and we were debriefing the unit, and our colonel was standing there, and our sergeant was giving the debriefing, when the colonel walked up to him and whispered something, and he just said, the colonel said, "I hate to tell you, but Kennedy had been shot," and I don't know if folks know it or not, but Kennedy was really responsible for, or had a lot to do with the authorization of the Green Beret for the Special Forces, and he was really loved by our troops. And everybody just stood there, and all we could think about was who did it, you know, why they did it, and how's that going to involve us? And, boy, everybody, the rest of our guys were crying. Everybody, I think all the troops were crying because they had a real love for this guy. And that's my memory. And we had to go back to the units and stay there, and we were pretty well restricted because we didn't know what was going to happen. You know.
Yeah, Bob, it must have been an interesting time to be in the military, certainly in those first few hours and days. Thank you very much for your reflection as well. Ingrid in Saxton's River says, I was in high school sitting in class, and all of a sudden we were listening to a special news announcement over the PA system. I clearly remember the voice saying, the president and the governor of Texas have been shot. My initial reaction, no doubt I was in shock, was, what is he saying? There is no president of Texas. They let us out of school early. I got home as quickly as I could, and I ran into my mother's arms and sobbed. She was crying, too. We truly had been innocent before this happened. A leader being shot was something from history class, and we never imagined it would happen in 1960s America. Matt Dickinson, what about that? You hear a lot of people saying the country lost its innocence or we lost our innocence individually on that day. Is that reflected in analysis?
Again, it's interesting that we commemorate his presidency by remembering where we were when it ended. And I think that tells us a lot because it was a presidency that showed so much promise, but the promise was unfulfilled. And so we read into that, in a sense, a great loss of what might have been. But the reality is it's not clear that what might have been was nearly as good as what we imagine it could have been. He faced a number of intractable problems that he was struggling with when he died. Civil rights, certainly. We forget the nature of the Cold War. It was at its height. And, of course, the Cuban Missile Crisis was the closest we ever came to actually turning that Cold War into a shooting war, at least directly between the two superpowers at the time. Not clear. I mean, he had begun taking steps with negotiating this atmospheric test ban on the testing of nuclear weapons in the atmosphere. But still, we were embroiled in South Vietnam. He, in fact, had gotten us deeper into that. The economy was beginning to pick up, but there's still pockets of poverty. So it's the loss of innocence, I think, has more to do with us looking nostalgically backwards at what we think might have happened had he lived, rather than any realistic assessment of where his presidency was going.
We're going to continue on that thread and hear from more of you as we reflect on President Kennedy's assassination today and coming together in groups around the country, coming together as individuals and communities to talk about what it means to us. We're going to look at what effect it's had on today's politics and culture. And listeners, you can share your reflections of that day on the Vermont Edition Facebook page or call with your thoughts on how they've affected your politics and culture today. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. Scott says, I was a medical intern at the Veterans Hospital in Kansas City, Missouri. The impulse was to simply stop and watch TV, but we had patients to take care of, most of whom were World War II veterans, like President Kennedy. I think it was the first time I had seen bunches of grown-ups cry. Add your thoughts again on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We'll be right back. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Matt Dickinson is with us today. He's a professor of political science at Middlebury College who teaches about the presidency, and he's helping us analyze both the significance of the Kennedy assassination in American politics in the 1960s, but also what effect it's had on our culture and politics today. We're hearing from many of you. Will says, it's hard to overestimate what this meant to my family. Mom and Dad were both Irish Catholics. My mom worked on JFK's senatorial campaign. He symbolized, as he himself said, a torch passed to a new generation, and they were that generation. Mary says, I remember coming home from grade school and finding my mother watching the news while ironing and crying. My mom also had her rosary beads in the hand that was doing the ironing. One Vermonter, Kenny O'Donnell of Westford, had a particularly close and unusual connection to the White House. His father, Kenneth O'Donnell Sr., was JFK's special assistant and close friend. On the day of the assassination, Kenneth O'Donnell Sr. was in the motorcade, riding in the car behind Kennedy's. At the hospital in Dallas, O'Donnell played a pivotal role in deciding that the president's body should be quickly flown to Washington and that Vice President Lyndon Johnson should be sworn in immediately. That day, 50 years ago, Kenny O'Donnell Jr. was a teenager in school in Washington. I spoke with him this morning about what he remembers.
I was 15 years old. I was a football player at a place called Gonzaga High School, which was on North Capitol Street, within view of the Capitol. And I oftentimes would go to the White House to get a ride home in that period of time. So I would oftentimes see the president when he was president. But we actually really knew the family. My father went to Harvard with Bobby Kennedy. So I knew exactly what my father did, because I used to lick envelopes and so forth when we were really little.
So on this day 50 years ago, what do you remember?
I was pulled out of class. I was in high school, and I was pulled out by the headmaster. He had a radio in his office, and he brought me in. He didn't want me to hear the news because he knew who my father was. He wanted to give me the news.
Did you know where your father was? Were you concerned at all about him, given that he was in the motorcade?
Oh, yeah, I was very concerned about him because he was in the next opening car.
How quickly was he able to get word to your family that he was okay?
We didn't know he was okay until we saw him on TV. Because, you know, no cell phones in those days, and there was just too much going on at that hospital, you know. And then they had to deal with, after the president was pronounced dead, they had to deal with the logistics of what was going to happen then, because the Dallas police did not want to release the body for investigative purposes. And my father, actually, who was basically de facto chief of staff, overruled the Dallas police. And my father said, we're going to put the body on the plane, and Lyndon has to be sworn in immediately. We don't know what's going on.
In a lot of ways, it sounds like your father was really running things in terms of making sure that all the details were taken care of.
He really was for that brief period of time. And he actually was, you know, really instrumental in getting President Johnson's, you know, feet wet once he got into office. My father did stay for a while.
How did JFK's assassination affect your father and your family's life?
My family and my father were never, ever the same. It was, realistically, in 1963, the president was living in the afterglow of the Cuban Missile Crisis success, and it was looking forward to a landslide in the 64 election. So we all figured we were going to be in Washington for quite a while longer, and we really enjoyed it there. And my father was never this one. And then he started getting a little bit better, and then Bobby was assassinated. So he had a tough time. You know, he's already had the best job he was ever going to have in his life, and he lost his best friend.
So for you, what is today like?
Well, today's a sad day for me. Because my father, of course, had been gone for a long, long time, so that memory comes back as well.
That's Kenny O'Donnell of Westford. His father was Kennedy's special assistant and close friend, Kenneth O'Donnell Sr. Interesting reflections from somebody who was fairly close to the action at that time. We're hearing from many of you listeners about what you remember of the events of November 22nd, 1963. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your reflections on the Vermont Edition Facebook page and engage with other listeners there. Let's go to Joe calling in from Marshfield. Hi, Joe. Go ahead.
Hi. What a show. Yeah, I was. I'm from Montpelier, Vermont, originally. I was 14 years old. Stayed back a year. I was in the seventh grade. I remember like this one person said it was a beautiful day that day. Catholic school. My little beautiful little nun, seventh grade teacher, had pictures of John Kennedy all over the wall. When the news came, they let school out, and all of a sudden, a big cloud came over the country. And I'm not just saying figuratively, literally. It got kind of lousy out. Everybody was crying. Everybody was miserable. This man was Matt Crutchton wants to critique his presidency and the job he did, a couple of years he did. But this guy was a war hero, a visionary, started the Peace Corps. This guy was so wonderful. This destroyed our country. I haven't felt that lousy since I saw two people holding hands jumping out of the Trade Center. That's how bad this was.
It's interesting. You know, you're reflecting there on the parallels with 9/11. Senator Leahy did as well. And certainly for a newer generation, 9/11 is the moment that they remember where they were, what they were wearing, what was happening at that time. You know, each generation has that moment. You know, Joe is saying, look, there was a lot of good stuff that Kennedy did and wonderful things that make him worth the reverence that he has. But Zoltan posted online saying, Americans love to idolize. Lest we forget, JFK was a huge womanizer. If he were in office today, he would be disgraced and out of office. His transgressions were way beyond Bill Clinton's. The Kennedy clan was powerful and privileged, able to power through scandal and indiscretion. Jackie suffered at John's hand and yet stuck by him. She's the real person to idolize. Matt Dickinson, a professor of political science at Middlebury College, is with us. And Matt, I'd love for you to sort of tie those issues together. You know, we are idolizing Kennedy in a lot of ways, but here's Zoltan saying, look, it's not all good news.
Well, certainly his private behavior by contemporary standards was despicable towards women. Not just the affairs, but affairs with people who are working for him. And he's in a position of authority. And newspaper men and journalists at the time knew about this. But again, while I understand the criticism of his private life, the question is whether he would have performed that type of – he would have acted in such a way today when the distinction between private and public is eroded. I mean, he operated at a time where, for the most part, people ignored your private life as long as you were doing well in your public setting. That's changed, of course. So in some sense, this gets to the issue that I started this conversation with. We tend to put our current standards, our current views on politics, we impose them back on Kennedy, and we interpret his presidency both through the current lens but also through this rosy idea that somehow things were better then and would have turned out better. But he, like all our presidents, had feet of clay. He was a mixed bag. His record is a mixed bag. There are certainly parts of his legacy that endure in a favorable sense, but there are certainly parts that we look on in a negative sense. It's a mixed record. The other thing I want to say is we tend to think of him as wildly popular, but he was not. His approval ratings were dropping steadily from a high of the high 70% when he was elected down to just above 50%, which looks great compared to Obama today. But they were dropping and probably would have continued dropping until the 1964 election. So he was not universally popular at the time he was president, although, again, he had a strong following, particularly among Catholics.
How do you think his assassination shifted American politics, or did it?
I think it did in one very tangible way. It allowed Lyndon Johnson to push forward parts of Kennedy's agenda that might otherwise not have seen success, partly on the slogan, "Let us continue." Kenny O'Donnell's son talked about how his father served for a while with LBJ. That was a conscious decision by LBJ. He incorporated much of Kennedy's senior staff into his White House as a symbol of that continuity. And he made a public appeal to Congress in trying to push legislation, the civil rights legislation, the Civil Rights Act of 64 and later the Voting Rights Act of 65, by pointing back to Kennedy's legacy and saying, we want to continue what Kennedy started but was unable to finish. So in a very real sense, it changed the legacy, Kennedy's legacy. It allowed his successor to burnish that legacy.
Let's go to Joseph, who's calling in from Marshfield. Hi, Joseph. Go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to ask Professor Dickinson about his statement regarding we really can't say which direction the president's administration was going in because it was cut so short. I just remember that in his American University speech in June of 1963, he offered what looks to me like a hand of peace toward the Soviet Union, recognizing how the Soviets had suffered so greatly during the Second World War. And many do consider that speech as a part of a larger effort on his part to reach an rapprochement with the Soviets and perhaps have avoided what subsequently became a huge destructive foreign policy vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. Does Professor Dickinson not think that that indicated a direction that he was going in?
Professor Dickinson?
The caller is right. And again, the record is mixed. Rhetorically, Kennedy was clearly making moves to try to come to some – to anticipate a word that came up later, détente with the Soviet Union. And the Atmospheric Test Ban Treaty, which I alluded to earlier, was an early indication of that. The Cuban Missile Crisis was a searing event for both sides, and they realized that they could never let themselves get in that predicament again. On the other hand, we have Vietnam, and Kennedy inadvertently tied the United States' interests much closer to South Vietnam by sanctioning a coup against the South Vietnamese leader, Diem. Now, he did not sanction the assassination of Diem, which took place without Kennedy's approval, and Kennedy was appalled by it. But nonetheless, he did order the military, or gave the green light for the military in South Vietnam, to overthrow their leader. And so it's unclear whether we can say with any certainty what he would have done with Vietnam. And more generally, foreign policy. It's such a mixed bag. We have the Bay of Pigs invasion, the botched Bay of Pigs invasion. We have the Cuban Missile Crisis. We have Vietnam. We have a variety of proxy wars. We know he's trying to overthrow Castro even after the Bay of Pigs. He's got assassination attempts going on. And so it's very hard to come to an overall conclusion that says he was moving in one direction.
When you teach about JFK in classes, are your students surprised to learn this kind of information based on what's out there in the culture?
Yeah, they are. Part of it reflects just the, you know, most political science students come to Middlebury College, and I'm sure in other places, having taken the standard high school civics curriculum, and it always seems like you run out of time in high school and you end somewhere after World War II. You start with Washington, you end up World War II. They never get into the modern era. And so they're generally not very aware historically of what Kennedy's presidency, his legacy was. But then when we talk about Kennedy, it's always in the context of his death. And so they don't really know the substance. And part of what you have to do is separate out his death, his and the great tragedy that was, from his accomplishments, his actual record as president. And there's a tendency, again, for students to sort of imbibe this Camelot myth, which, by the way, the Kennedy people themselves pushed mightily after his death, this notion of Camelot, most famously Jackie Kennedy in her interviews with William Manchester after the assassination.
Let's go to Richard calling in from Lindenville. Hi, Richard. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I think part of the popularity of the president and Kennedy, particularly with young people who aren't alive, is that the president is obviously the face of America. He's kind of our collective self-image. And I think that this generation, for whatever it's worth, is consumed with style. And here was a president who was remarkably stylish, as was Jackie. And the combination of the two and their charisma and intelligence and good looks is really part of the appeal, because that style was the sort of projection of America to the world and to ourselves. And we've never had a president anything like that since. And so I'm not sure that it's really anything to do with politics or even the kind of sense of innocence about the era. I was a second grader at the time, and I was sick at home watching children's television, and it was interrupted.
Richard, you know, it sounds like no matter what age you were, this was something that affected everybody. I'm sorry to cut you off there, but interesting talking about style for today's generation especially. Appreciate that comment. And Matt Dickinson, I appreciate you being with us to give us some context into the actual politics of the time. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Jane.
Matt Dickinson is a professor of political science at Middlebury College. He joined us from the campus studio. Listeners, you can continue to share your thoughts with us. Go to the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Tell us where you were and how you're reflecting on that time today. Coming up, we stay at Middlebury College to have a look at a new collection of Civil War letters the college has acquired that sheds light on the lives of some Vermont soldiers in that war. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Middlebury College alum John McHenry had a shoebox in his California home full of family letters from the Civil War era. Inspired by a gift of documents to his alma mater, McHenry decided Middlebury College was also the right place for his collection. This past summer, he flew them to Vermont himself on the occasion of his college reunion. McHenry gave 85 documents, including about 80 letters, to the college. I recently visited with Rebecca Irwin, Director of Collections and Archives at Middlebury College, to find out what these documents reveal about the lives of young Vermont soldiers in the Civil War.
And the dates of the letters are generally between 1860 and 1865, generally written by two brothers, John and George Quilty, to their sister Eliza. There was another brother, Benjamin Quilty, who received letters. He was living in Rutland, but their sister, Eliza, was living in Brandon. And they include letters between the brothers and their sister, the brothers back to their mother, and another friend, who we don't exactly know who he is, writing both to their sister and to the brothers.
And what were these brothers doing? They were soldiers for the North?
Both of the brothers were soldiers, along with their friend, and they were writing both from camps and training in Burlington, but then as far as Virginia and New Orleans, back and forth, stationed back in Burlington, and then as they shipped out. And some of the letters, of course, don't tell us where they're from.
And did both the brothers survive and their friend?
They did not, sadly. One of the brothers, whose name was George H. Quilty, died at age 20. The other brother did survive, and we believe the friend did as well.
What's the content of these letters? You've read through at least some of them. You said 80 letters, so what are they talking about?
What we have found as we've read the letters is that they cover everything from the everyday mundane duties of camp. The brothers write home about how good the food is and how bad the food is. They write back about death and disease and just waiting. There was a lot of sitting around and waiting for bad weather, waiting until they found their orders for the next day. Also, many of the letters describe the politics of the day. So we have one letter in particular where one brother writes about old Abe's decisions that he'll be making about a draft, and another where a brother writes about the injuries that happened on the battlefield and another soldier's loss of limbs. So they're quite graphic in detail.
Would you mind reading one of the letters? You have them here.
I'll read one that's from Hammond, the friend of the family, to Luke. It's from a camp near White Oak Church, Virginia, March 21st, 1868. Friend Luke, I sit down this morning to write you a few lines to let you know that I'm alive and kicking. I hope this will find you the same. That was a tip-top picture you sent me. I will send you one of home manufacture got up expressly for the purpose. What have you been doing to the soldiers' wives up there in Vermont? Almost all the married men that has been home on furlough have come back with long faces. Some found their wives had run away with other fellows. Others found their wives considerably stouter around the waist than when they left home. But I don't know of any more patriotic business than raising young soldiers when there are so much needed by the government. There's no knowing how long this war will last, and the best way to ensure success in the long run is to keep the mills at home to work. I suppose I will see you down here pretty soon after old Abe makes his next call for troops, which I suppose he will make very soon. I guess you are nailed this time, Luke.
And then the letter actually goes on. This is, looks like quite a long letter. So Luke was home in Vermont at this point?
Luke was, what, as far as we know, Luke was in Rutland, Vermont, and Hammond, his friend and a friend of the family, was writing from Virginia, from a camp station in Virginia. And you're right, the letter goes on for 4 pages. And parts of the letter, again, he goes on after the passage I just read to talk about the food that they're eating and that they are getting fat on beef. He says exactly... We are living first rate here now. We have all the soft bread we can eat, lots of potatoes and fresh beef. We are getting fat as hogs, which we resemble very much, which seems a strange thought during the Civil War. But it's one of the fascinating things about these letters is as much that we think we're familiar with the Civil War, when you read intimate stories like this, particularly from young men in their 20s, and there's something I think even more intimate about them, knowing that they're from Vermont, so close to home. It seems that you learn something new each time you read them, and I've now read this letter 3 or 4 times only today.
Have you read all of the letters?
I have not read all the letters. One of the things we found when the collection came was that some of the letters are quite faded. The letters are in a combination of pencil and pen in ink from the time, and the pencil has actually done a little bit better over the 100 years or so, 200 years, the pen is fading. So we're actually scanning the letters right now and using some digital techniques to try to bring out the letters that we can't read.
You have a letter here underneath that is in very flowery writing. I assume each of the letter writers has a different style, but whose is this? It almost looks like a very formal invitation that you'd get to, a ball or to a wedding.
We don't know who some of them are from. We have some letters that are miscellaneous, and this is one of them. But you're absolutely right. One of the brothers might write very differently depending on who he's writing to. And so I have another example of a letter that we're looking at that is from George Quilty, one of the brothers, to his mother. And he's doodled on it and decorated it, so all of his letters have the heads of eagles on them. And he doesn't write the same way when he writes to his brothers, so he added a flourish when he wrote home to his mother.
You mentioned that some of these letters, the ink has faded and they're very hard to read, so you're scanning them in and using this new technology to bring out the pigment or to bring out the writing. Are you planning to digitize all of these? Can people who are not connected to Middlebury see them someday, some way?
We are. So we're in the process of digitizing all of these letters, and we will make them available. And it was also part of our agreement with the donor. He'll receive digital copies of all of his letters so that he'll have them for his own collection. And that's actually quite common, not only at Middlebury, but the libraries and archives across the state. We're all spending time creating digital copies of the things in our collections because they don't exist anywhere else. And not everyone can come visit Barry or Middlebury or Burlington. And it's important for us to share these letters beyond the state of Vermont so that others can learn from our story and to preserve them. In fact, as we can see, because these letters are in front of us, some are quite fragile and falling apart. And a digital copy won't replace the original, but it will help us reduce the wear and tear on these originals.
Would you mind leaving us with an excerpt from one other of the letters that you think is particularly interesting or colorful?
Sure. One of the things that we hope these letters will do now that they're at Middlebury is serve a purpose for our students. Sometimes they can feel very distant to us, and even as we're looking at these letters, they're in cursive, but sometimes it's quite hard to read, and you have to spend a lot of time with the letters, almost deciphering them and translating them, even though they're in English. And our students, many who were born in the 1990s, struggle with reading cursive, as we all do when we're looking at 18th and 19th century handwriting. But some of the letters are so direct and written by brothers to a sister when they were in their 20s, I think they can't help but speak to young students also in their 20s. I don't think that a Middlebury student today can help but feel how real this history is when reading a letter from a brother to a sister talking about the mundane details of his life, whether or not it was a war experience or just a letter written back home. I think it's also very meaningful for us to have letters like this to share with our own students, because it will let them think about their own habits and the last time they wrote a letter, and in particular to think that these letters have survived over 200 years. And I think it's quite humbling for our own college students to think about what they're leaving behind to tell their own story. But here's a letter from Burlington, April 18th, 1862. And this is written by George Quilty to his mother. And he writes, "Dear Mother, I thought I would write to you a few lines to let you know how I was getting along. I am well and doing well. We are coming through Monday next anyway, so I can be at the depot. I hope you are well, and all the rest. I was glad I brought that provision, as I get most starved to death." George A. Quilty. This seems to be a terrible letter to write back to your mother to tell. So George is telling his mother he's doing just fine and he's starving to death. No mother wants to hear from her son that way, I think, in 1862 or today.
Well, Rebecca, thank you so much for showing me these letters. Just to see them is kind of amazing, and to hear the words that they wrote to one another. So I appreciate you taking the time to show me.
We appreciate sharing them with you.
Rebecca Irwin is the director of collections and archives at Middlebury College. She was talking about a collection of about 80 letters from the Civil War era that were recently donated to the college. We have scans of a few of those letters up at vpr.net. And that does it for today. Monday on the program, college rankings and the price of an education. President Obama has suggested a value rating system for colleges and universities. And more of those college ranking lists are trying to take into account whether the degree is worth the sticker price. On the next Vermont Edition, we'll talk about what value means when it comes to college education. And you can send your evaluation to vermontedition@vpr.net. Then join us for the discussion on Monday. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Tim Johnson. Peter Biello directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.